From Impact Alpha, welcome to This Week in Impact, where we take you inside the world of sustainable finance and meet the agents of impact who are working towards a better future. I'm Brian Walsh. It's Thursday, April 11th. Helping me break down this week's impact investing news and insights is Impact Alpha's founder and CEO, David Bank. We'll discuss how infrastructure investing seeks to reconnect communities from the legacy of racial segregation, the impact investing opportunity in Puerto Rico, and how more business owners are deciding to exit to employee ownership. All that and more on This Week in Impact. All right. Hi, David. How are you? What's the latest from Impact Alpha this week?
Hi, Brian. I'm great. We've been scrambling this week, but in a good way. We've got folks out in the field. We've had Dennis down in Puerto Rico. Rudy Sinatis has been in Washington, D.C. for this employee ownership ideas forum. I was over in San Francisco yesterday for the Elemental Interactive from Elemental Accelerator, a great climate event. So it's been a bit of a scramble, but in a good way. Lots going on.
Good to hear. And we'll get to some of those stories in just a bit. But first up, our first story, as Andrea Riccier reported this week in Impact Alpha, the Biden administration's Reconnecting Communities and Neighborhoods program was conceived a couple years ago with very lofty goals to stitch together communities torn apart by ill-conceived federal highways and to undo the legacy of racial segregation from previous decades. Now, a second round of the Reconnecting Communities Awards was announced in mid-March, bringing the program total to $3.5 billion for 177 projects. From Alaska to Wyoming, communities have received grants that will enable either construction or planning for projects ranging from bus rapid transit to pedestrian bridges over highways. Now, David, what's the context behind this big federal program?
Well, I love this topic because when I was a young reporter, I spent a bunch of time in the South Bronx in New York, and that neighborhood is still reeling from the Cross Bronx Expressway, which was made famous in a classic book, The Power Broker, by Robert Carrer about Robert Moses. But that pattern of a interstate, you know, cutting through, generally speaking, a poor and often a black or brown community, and disrupting and cutting off the neighborhoods, has been repeated all across the country. You know, in the great era of urban redevelopment and highway construction. And now we're starting to see the rebound or the reversal of those bad effects with this policy and this funding that you're talking about. Right here in California, where I am now, we had a act of God of some sort, but the 89 earthquake knocked down the Nimitz Freeway that divided West Oakland from the rest of Oakland. That's now come down and been rerouted. And I wouldn't say it's been, you know, monumental, but it definitely has a different feel in that neighborhood now. And even the Embarcadero Freeway, which ran right along the waterfront in San Francisco, which also came down as a result of the earthquake, that has opened up that whole waterfront and made the San Francisco downtown and neighborhood, you know, a completely different place than it was before. So you can see what happens when these freeways come down, or in the case of some of these projects, as you say, they build bridges over it, they connect bike paths, they do all kinds of things that reconnect these communities that have been divided by these, you know, monstrous, you know, concrete, you know, expressways with trucks and cars running through them 24/7. And so it's quite a good example of kind of both redressing racial and social harms of an earlier day and a kind of social engineering in a good way.
Yeah, and also building for the future and building for future investment.
Well, a lot of it is that this is good real estate. Like, you put a bridge, you underground some of these freeways, and you put some, you know, you create some land on top of them, and people, you know, St. Louis has made a whole set of parks, you know, connecting these black neighborhoods, transit hubs, cultural and educational institutions. So you're creating real estate, which is really the source of wealth.
Now, $3.5 billion from federal dollars to redress these kind of historic wrongs is sounds like a lot of money, but, you know, in fact, many more funds are going to be required to get these projects off the ground. The federal grants in many of these cities aren't enough to cover the cost. So how are communities going to be able to fill in the gap in their capital stack in getting these projects completed?
Well, this is becoming, you know, a theme across, you know, many stories, including some of the ones we'll talk about today, of just how do you, like you say, capital stacks, how do you blend public and private? How do you blend commercial and philanthropic, and how do you create projects that work, you know, across all of those sectors. And folks are getting pretty good at it. I would say this is a kind of skill set that impact investors have honed for many years, and it's becoming more and more valuable, which is, you know, these kind of complex financing structures that, you know, mitigate risk for somebody or enhance returns for somebody else, or bring in a partner, bring in a, you know, like I said, if you're creating real estate and you're putting up housing or commercial areas in areas that hadn't been viable before, you know, there's obvious ways to collect, you know, both tax revenues, but also, you know, direct fees and investments in the projects. So again, it's a, you know, it's complicated. Often it takes a long time. One of the things we learned in this story that Andrea did was that this whole process has brought together stakeholders locally in many of these places. And so you have it, you know, you think it might be a transportation project, but it really becomes a housing project or a green belt project, or even a, you know, a you know, children's recreation or other kinds of things. And so you start to bring in different folks that are, might not be natural or typical allies, and put these projects together.
Now, as Andrea noted in the piece, and I want you to kind of help me unpack this a little bit, where does the $4 trillion municipal bond market come into play here?
Well, municipal bonds are not only sort of the original impact investments in the sense that they fund infrastructure and sewers and schools and whatnot, they're also a source of cheap capital because they're backed by, you know, creditworthy cities, generally speaking, or they're made creditworthy in various ways. And so often you can fund things through municipal bonds at a much lower cost of capital than, you know, going out and raising money in sort of equity or even debt markets. I will say the other way it comes into play is that the muni market back in the day was the vehicle for some of these bad projects. So there's both a sort of legacy from the bad old days, and now sort of new creativity around what folks have thought of as a pretty stodgy, you know, financing mechanism. You know, muni bonds are kind of sitting there in people's portfolios. They don't think much about them. They're safe. They pay a little bit of a premium, and there you go. But now folks are thinking, wow, we can use this mechanism to fund some of these projects. You know, if you have a cash flow, you have some revenue stream, whether it's rents or fees or something else. You know, you can, you know, essentially securitize that in a sense, and maybe if you have an agency or a state agency, a local agency that has the ability to go to the bond market, you know, get cheap capital.
And indeed, the bond market is also coming to realize that, you know, pro-community projects are good, not just for the people in the communities, but also good for the balance sheet of the investors.
Absolutely. Yeah. Lower risk, more, you know, higher chance of paying off, you know, all kinds of ancillary benefits. You know, you start a kind of a virtuous circle of uplift, you know, like a lot of these, you know, highway projects, you know, create, you know, vibrant neighborhoods that's good for, you know, small shopkeepers and small businesses, you know, it's good for the housing market. You know, there's ways now to sort of share the benefits, share the costs and move forward together.
All right. Well, we look forward to more coverage of the Reconnecting Communities and Neighborhoods program in the digital pages of Impact Alpha. Let's take a quick break, David. When we come back, the impact investing opportunity that is Puerto Rico.
I'm Eric Carmen Gonzalez, Impact Alpha's Director of Subscription Growth. Ever feel like there's so much happening, it's hard to keep up? We hear you. That's why we created Impact Alpha Latin America, a monthly newsletter for impact investors who want to keep their eye on trends and investments happening in Latin America and the Caribbean. Follow the money and connect with agents of impact powering Latin America's impact economy. Visit our Instagram page at Impact Alpha and click on the link in our bio to sign up.
Our own Dennis Price is in San Juan this week at the Nexa Jobs Summit. Impact Alpha is the media partner for the event put on by Platform for Social Impact. Now, David, we know that Puerto Rico struggles with access to capital and unstable power grids. What's the word from our man in Puerto Rico this week?
Yeah, I just spoke with Dennis, and he couldn't have been more excited. It's kind of a, I don't know, a moment. They're calling it a moment. In fact, I think they had a clock on the wall or on the screen of 10 years to put to use what is apparently about $85 billion of federal money in different buckets. But, you know, Puerto Rico has had a sort of you know, people talk about the poly crisis broadly, but Puerto Rico has had the poly crisis locally, you know, dating back at least to Hurricane Maria back in 2017. But there's been other hurricanes, earthquakes, COVID, you know, a near bankruptcy, and all kinds of issues that relate to its kind of odd status as a territory that's part of the U.S. but not a state. And so it's really got a set of challenges that have held back the recovery and broadly speaking, the development. Now they do have this pot of federal money, and the big fear is that either it won't get spent and it's been slow to, you know, to disperse, or that it'll get spent in a way that doesn't actually, you know, engender this long-term recovery. So this conference has been a way to bring, again, the catalytic capital providers, you know, some government agencies, the blended finance folks, the impact investing world, and say, how can we provide some catalytic capital that will free the federal money, that will in turn free the commercial money, and set in motion, again, this kind of virtuous cycle of development. And I think what I take to be the takeaway there is it's not just sort of getting this money out the door, but it's kind of creating the long-term institutions and capacity that will then be able to, you know, channel more capital and into smart development there. So trying to lay groundwork with this moment, as they're saying, for the long term.
Now, indeed, the long term is a challenge because, you know, Puerto Rico has some, you know, challenging demographic trends that they're facing. They have an aging population, and nearly 60% of children there are living in poverty. So how does the island really think about impact investing in responding to all of the needs that they face?
Well, one of the demographic trends, I think it's true that more Puerto Ricans live outside of Puerto Rico than live in Puerto Rico. So one of the goals, I think, of this kind of development idea is to, you know, make folks see opportunities and their future, you know, back home in Puerto Rico and even some of the diaspora to come back. A lot of the focus apparently is on children and youth and families and economic mobility. You know, it's not just, you know, hard infrastructure, it's social infrastructure at some level. And again, you know, some of it is very nitty gritty. Like a lot of these federal programs are only reimbursable. So you can get paid back after you've done the work, but how do you finance and have the wherewithal to get the work done in the first place? So there's notions of bridge loans to get folks across that divide. There's been a big increase in the number of community development financial institutions, CDFIs. Folks on this podcast will remember that we think that's a key mechanism to reach down into communities and be able to actually make loans. It turns out that it's not only capital at the sort of top of the funnel, but it's actually the ability to put it on the ground locally in a smart and responsible way and find the right projects and manage them over time. So, again, building capacity locally, focusing on children and families, focusing on creating an equitable future there and getting everybody on board. But Dennis said the energy was contagious and very exciting.
Yeah, and after the, as you mentioned, the natural disasters of the hurricanes of Maria and Irma and the 2020 earthquake and the natural disaster that was COVID, things are on the upswing right now. You know, Puerto Rico is experiencing a historically low unemployment rate, 5.7% in January 2024, compared to the average of 14.2% between 1976 and 2023. And measure of progress called the Economic Activity Index, which is developed by the Puerto Rico Economic Development Bank, shows that there has been growth for the last 3 years in a row. So, you know, this is the an island on the upswing. And so it's exciting to see what impact investors are going to make of it.
Well, Puerto Rico certainly deserves a break.
And so do we. So let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll discuss how more owners are selling their companies to their workers.
Hi, I am Salema Beeble, Impact Alpha's Chief Operating Officer. SOCAP 24 is just around the corner, and the proposed sessions are live and voting is underway. Impact Alpha is proud to be among the submissions. Check out the link in our Instagram bio and our show notes to learn more about our sessions, The Great Deployment with Amy Cortese, the Napoleon Wallace documentary with David Bank, and Dennis Price Chat with ReFed's Alexandra Corey. The deadline to vote is this Sunday, April 14th. Don't wait and vote today.
All right, finally this week, the growing ownership economy. As Rudy Sanantes reported this week, when a business owner looks to sell or exit their company, a growing number are looking to sell to their own employees, rather to an external buyer like a private equity fund. But conversions to worker ownership can be complex for retiring business owners, balancing the need to keep the company going for the long haul while trying to preserve the spirit of what they've built, all the while seeking to maximize their own upside. Now, David, some have referred to the forthcoming silver tsunami of retiring baby boomers looking to hand off the companies they've built. Can you walk us through what's driving the shift towards employee-led buyouts?
Well, like you say, folks are getting older, including all of us. And as owners want to exit, they have, a couple or three options. Many folks, just shut down their business, which always to me seems a shame, both for their own, sake and their legacy, as well as their pocketbook, as you say, but certainly for the workers and even for the communities, where that business, provided a service. Sometimes they sell to their competitors, and, so a nursery or something gets bought up by a nursery chain or something like that. And maybe they do some minor cutbacks. Sometimes they sell to private equity, which is rolling up these things just really for the cash flows and generally speaking doesn't, necessarily care about the jobs or the business. And so one thing that's becoming appealing both at a financial level and also at this legacy and community spirit level is selling to your employees. The gap has been, or the obstacle has been, if you're the owner, the old owner, and you generally speaking have had to essentially loan your own employees the money and put out a note, and then that note gets repaid over time from the proceeds and the revenues of the company, which means that you're the owner and you want to go sit on the beach, you don't have your money for many years. So therefore, they go sometimes even for a lower price and go to private equity, take their check, and they're done. So the question is, how could funds come in and help finance these conversions? In a sense, make the loan to the employees that the owner might have had to make, and then the fund gets paid back over time. The owner gets his check, and the employees over time gain ownership through the revenues of the business. It's important to know in almost all of these cases, the employees do not put out actual cash to buy the business, and nor do they get have to take it out of their own paychecks. It comes out of the revenues and the profits of the business.
Yeah, that's an important point to note. And can you give us an example of where this has worked effectively?
Well, there's, we've been covering, some of these particular transactions. There we just had one on a construction firm in Denver. I think they had like 40 employees, more than half of them women and or people of color. I think they had done some work on the Denver airport and that sort of thing. And this fund that we've been covering a lot called Apis and Heritage helped them buy it out. And they say that the worker owners will ultimately be able to retire with something like, 70,000 to 120,000 in savings. So it, it's not, possibly a life changer, but it's a significant chunk. And can be leveraged in various ways as well. So there's starting to be more of these transitions, and in particular, starting to be more of these funds. So this is becoming now, from sort of Impact Alpha readers' point of view, something that you can invest in. You can invest in these funds that then drive these employee ownership and models. So fund managers are working out the models to get these done kind of at scale. There's a bunch of policy things that are in play and that will make it even easier. But even before that, we're starting to see that this is an investable asset class and that investors can actually help employees, buy the companies.
To reiterate, just to emphasize there, though, when you're talking about investable asset class, you're talking about the debt financing that's provided by these new fund managers that allows the retiring or outgoing owner to have cash in hand and allows the entity of the company to pay it back that note over time to the fund manager through the profits and proceeds of the company.
Right. It's been a little bit of a complicated, terrain to navigate because there's a lot of acronyms and different programs and structures. I think people know now about ESOPs, employee stock ownership plans, and those are sort of the bread and butter of these kind of conversions. And they do have some terrific tax advantages for the surviving, you know, not surviving, but the ongoing company. But they're also expensive and complicated in various ways. There's a newer form that's called an employee ownership trust. It's popular in the UK in particular, but it's becoming more popular here. And it's not exactly the same as employee ownership, but a trust owns it, and the employees have governance rights in the trust, and the trust's structure is usually set up to do profit sharing and that sort of thing. So it comes back, the money comes back to the employees in a slightly different way. It's much cheaper to structure these things, and so it's quicker, and so it's becoming popular in the U.S. and I think in Canada as well.
So we have ESOPs and ELBOs and EOTs, oh my. Now, beyond APIS and Heritage, who are some of the other players in this space?
One outfit we've been tracking closely is Common Trust. I think we had Zoe Schlag on the podcast last year. They're keen on these employee ownership trusts. They just did a deal in Texas with a software company called Textimal, and helped, I think, their 42 employees set up a structure to buy it out over time. And as I said, employee ownership trusts are much cheaper than employee stock ownership plans. There's Project Equity. Allison Lingane, I think, also has been on the podcast. They're having an employee ownership summit down in LA next month that we'll be at. There's a private equity fund called Mosaic. We've had them on an Agents of Impact call. They are of a type that I think will become more common. A kind of small business investment company that has an arrangement with the SBA to be able to access cheap federal loan money. And there's, as I said, there's legislation pending to make that structure easier. And when that happens, if and when that happens, there wouldn't be just this handful of funds. There might be hundreds or thousands of funds. And that's what's needed, really, because as you mentioned, there's a whole tsunami, as people say, of businesses coming on the market that need these kind of structures. So this has got to, we've got to have these kind of funds in every city and every sector, every size of company, because otherwise, they're going to go to private equity and be shut down or what have you. So it really is both a huge opportunity and also a huge challenge.
So what you're saying, David, is the boomer legacy might not just be making housing unaffordable for millennials and Gen Z, but in fact, transitioning this economy to more of a worker-owned economy.
Well, just look around your neighborhood. I don't know where about your neighborhood, but here there are all kinds of stores that used to be very, pillars of the neighborhood that have shut down. And the bakery on the corner, which was everybody's favorite place, the owners, aging out and wanted to retire, and they just shut it down. And I'm like, what a shame. It's not just the workers that lost their job, but we lost our bakery. And couldn't they have sold it to the workers or found some way to keep that ongoing? And I think, as far as I know, successful business going. And so I think, people have we all have a stake in it, not just the employees and the exiting owners, in keeping neighborhoods, with the kinds of businesses that everybody, needs to and likes to have around them.
Won't somebody please think of the bakery customers?
Absolutely. Maybe we'll have a bakery customer trust of some sort.
Yeah, for those Berkeley bakery customers, indeed. All right, well, that's a good place to leave it. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you, Brian, despite the dig.
Well, and thank you all for listening to This Week in Impact. Now, David, what's the best way for people to contact us with feedback?
Our dedicated email for this show is podcast@impactalpha.com. So send us your thoughts, your suggestions, and keep your criticism to yourself.
Yeah, we love hearing the feedback. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to this podcast, as they say, wherever you listen, and share this with a friend or colleague. If you really want to help the show out, be sure to rate us and give us a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find the show. This Week in Impact is a production of Impact Alpha and part of the Impact Alpha Podcast Network, bringing you investment news for a sustainable edge. For more exclusive stories about the world of impact investing and sustainable finance, join other agents of impact by subscribing to Impact Alpha. Just go to impactalpha.com/subscribe for full access. Thanks to our producer extraordinaire, Isaac Silk. I'm Brian Walsh. We'll see you next week for more Impact.